Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another Fear Group webinar. We're excited to be here. Today's webinar is How Low Can You Go? Managing Specialty Drugs, Reducing Overall Pharmacy Spend, and Unraveling the Mystery Behind PBMs. It's a long title. We apologize, but there's just so much we want to cover this month. And based on the response and turnout from the industry as a whole, I guess this is something that you do want us to focus on. We ask nicely that you please don't ask us to tell you what PBMs you should work with, shouldn't work with, any of that type of information. We don't want to be sued by anybody, so just pick up the phone and call us or email us, and we'll give you our frank opinions on all that stuff as we see fit. As usual, with me is our Senior VP and General Counsel, Ron Epek. Say hello, Ron.
Hello, Ron.
As well as our Director of Provider Relations and just a great attorney here, John Javelin.
Hello, Ron.
And we also brought in, back by popular demand, we have Jennifer McCormick, our Vice President of Consulting.
Hello.
And then we have one special guest who we're going to bring in as well later on. We'll let her introduce herself when she starts talking. But we're excited to have her aboard for the first time as well. So really quickly, everyone understands, our next webinar that we're doing in November is a joint webinar being sponsored and promoted by HCAA, the great organization. It's tied to basically ethics, the good, the bad, and the naughty, on November 15th at 1 o'clock Eastern Time, talking about ethics from a simple mistake all the way to a breach. And then our normal webinars, the next one, the last one for 2016, will be on December 13th, 1 o'clock, and we're basically going to focus on 2017, stuff that we're seeing, things that need to be done, and just the cool stuff that we expect for the end of the year. As always, please feel free to email us your questions. Right there on the bottom, there's a little text box. And if we think it's a good question, we'll bring it up on the air. If not, we'll just ignore it. So with that, let's go to the next slide. So as always, feel free to email us at pgcreferral@feargroup.com for anything, whether it's cost containment, whether it's compliance, whether it's a plan design issue, a legal issue, whatever it might be, and ask us about ICE. If you've noticed that you've been sending us a lot of questions to PGC Referral, it might make sense for you to just work with us on a PEPM basis. So feel free to ask us about it. In a few short months, in about 4 months, we have roughly 300,000 employee lives that have now taken advantage of our ICE product. So feel free to email us at PGC Referral. So with that, based on the PGC Referral feedback, I'm going to turn it over to Jen McCormick, our fan favorite here. And before I do that, I want to make sure everyone knows I'm a major Cleveland Indians fan, and Jen is a Chicago Cubs fan. So I guess you could take sides. I told Jen that I would not look at her or talk to her this entire week. This is the first time that I've said hello to her. I actually didn't even say hello to you. I'm looking at you, though. But Jen is typical of a Chicago Cubs fan. She doesn't actually know any of the names of any of the players, which is fine. So I'm sure we're going to get some texts on that, the anti, you know, the people that are rooting for the Cubs. But if you're anywhere in this country other than Chicago, you probably should be rooting for the Indians. Anyway, with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jen to talk about our most frequently asked questions that have been coming to our PGC Referral email. Jen?
I just want to add that from my understanding, it does seem like everyone wants to be a Cubs fan, though, because everyone wants to root for the underdog.
Underdog?
Yeah.
All right, Jen, we'll do a separate webinar.
Right.
Underdog is not the word I'd use for Cubs. That's fine, though. Go ahead.
I'm just saying. I've been to a game or two back in the day. That's what kind of fan I am. All right, anyways, FAQ, the most popular questions from PGC Referral. All right, so there are a couple of things that not only we're getting a lot of questions about, but we thought it was appropriate to bring up as it's the end of the year and it's time to make any revisions if necessary to the documents that you are compliant for 2017. One of the big topics, one of the big questions, obviously, is related to the non-discrimination rules under 1557 of ACA, and that's about the notice requirements specifically. So we're getting a lot of questions about not necessarily what benefit language may need to be modified or adjusted or altered within the documents, but specifically, 1557 does have some notice requirement provisional language within the requirements of the law. So what does that notice requirement mean? What is the impact going to be for a plan that might actually be subject to 1557? So in short, there is the requirement under HHS about the notice of non-discrimination for those specific covered entities. And as of right now, the rules do not explicitly require that you include the notice, the non-discriminating notice, within the plan document itself. However, the argument is that the plan document or the SPD is a significant communication as described and defined by 1557. So it has been our recommendation and suggestion that if you have a group or you are a group that is subject to 1557, that you should distribute this notice requirement with the plan document. This could be separate, this could be an appendix, so this just could be distributed in any way that would be appropriate. But a conservative approach would be that 1557 notice requirements, if you are subject to them, should be communicated with the plan document, as a plan document would be likely considered to be a significant communication. And note that there are other requirements outside of the plan document for 1557 that you might want to take a look at if you do have some groups that need to comply with this for the upcoming plan year. The next issue is talking about the legal definition of a spouse and the common law. There's been a lot of confusion now about what happens, who needs to be covered, and who's actually a legal spouse. So specifically, there's been issues about when there are divorces and if you have a common law definition of a spouse under your plan, what do I need to do and who's required to be covered? So I'll point you back to the decision from the Supreme Court in the Hodges case, which did clarify that there is no such thing as an opposite sex only marriage, and that your plan documents should not refer to the state law definition of a spouse, because that has not been the case. That's not necessarily good law anymore at this point. So when you're taking a look at what the IRS is requiring you to do in combination with what the Supreme Court requirements are for defining a spouse, when you're talking about marriage, it does not specifically include a domestic partnership. A domestic partnership is different than a same-sex or opposite-sex marriage. It is a type of relationship. It is not a marriage. So when you are defining someone under your plan and you want to decide whether or not those individuals should be covered, you cannot consider someone within a domestic partnership relationship, whether or not you have documentation, they live together, they have joint bank accounts. Those factors and considerations do not make a marriage. So if you want to cover or you want to exclude domestic partnerships, you cannot necessarily consider that underneath the definition of a spouse under the IRS. And also keep in mind, when you're talking about a common law marriage, that's different than a domestic partnership. And oftentimes, the definition of what is or is not considered to be a domestic or to be a common law marriage is defined by state law. So if you want to cover someone or cover employees and their dependents through a common law marriage, that would be something you would need to specifically outline within the documents and make sure, as appropriate, they're asking for the validation or the justification of whether or not that relationship exists. And last but not least is the issue of what happens if there's a termination of a group's health plan when in the result of an acquisition or there is a merger between two companies. So oftentimes there are situations where an employer is either bought or sold by another employer, and that existing employer has a self-funded plan, and possibly the company that it is merging with or that is purchasing it also has a group health plan. What to do with the employees who are currently covered under both those plans? Well, the answer is it's going to depend, and it's going to depend on what type of relationship is outlined within the merger and acquisition agreement. So the safe choice to do in this situation is to make sure that how benefits will be covered or will not be covered is specifically outlined. Otherwise, there is no necessary compliance rule that would apply. This needs to be dictated by some other documentation about what is going to happen to these employees on a go-forward basis, unless they otherwise decide to terminate these agreements. So whether it's a 1557 question or you're trying to figure out what you need to do for your spousal coverage for 2017, or you're thinking about there's a group that's going to run into M&A type of issue, PGC referral is going to provide you with the answers. So and this is going to be, I think, the most exciting part of the webinar. Our newest member of the webinar team for today, Uliana, is going to be giving us a bit of a...
Your last name, Jen.
I'm going to let Uliana say that.
I'll butcher it.
If this is necessary. Well, people need to have your email address, right?
So if you have any questions about SPT, you can contact PGC Referral
And I will, most likely it will be me, Uliana Bevilacqua, who will respond to your question. So SBC, summary of benefits and coverage. Just a couple of words as a background of the SBC final rule. Under the Affordable Care Act, health plans are required to provide a brief summary of what the plan covers and the cost-sharing responsibility of the consumer in order to help individuals make more informed choices among health plan options and better understand their coverage. The initial SBC rules came into effect in 2012. In 2014, the department updated the SBC template with additional language indicating whether the plan provides minimum essential coverage and minimum value. This year, the department issued a revised SBC template and associated documents with a more extensive number of changes. The new SBC templates include changes that improve readability for consumers, as well as changes that allow plans to provide more details about their benefits, increasing their appeal to the consumers at the same time. Such improvements include an additional coverage example that demonstrates the cost-sharing amounts an individual might be responsible for in case of an emergency scenario such as a foot fracture. The template also provides enhanced language to explain deductibles and embedded out-of-pocket maximums. This change appears to be especially important with enactment of the new ACA rule requiring non-grandfathered plans to embed self-only out-of-pocket maximum for each individual enrolled in family coverage. Additional changes include more comprehensive description of maternity services, now providing three line items for office visits, delivery professional, and facility services. Mandated language in the limitations, exceptions, and other important information column for preventive services and maternity services as well. The SBC instructions now include some details that plans should pay close attention to, such as a special rule on cross-reference to the summary plan description in the SBC document.
So how long are these SBCs now? I mean, this is insane. Like, how many pages are we talking about potentially becoming? And this is all in effect in April, right?
Right.
So how many pages are we thinking here?
The 8 pages.
But this will be able to fit within the 8 pages, all this
yeah.
new stuff?
The funny thing is, the original incentive, if you read the SBC instructions, which we have and it's really exciting, is that they actually cut the template down. So these new rules are outlining their attempts, they say, to cut the SBC down. It's not cut down.
So basically, we have this ready to go. So if any client needs this, we can now start helping them, assist them, put these SBCs together, Uliana?
Yes, definitely. So we can provide new SBC drafts, as well as we can provide the revised SBC draft. We can also draft plan or group-specific templates that meets your specific requirements or expectations. You can send all the requests to PGC Referral, and we will be happy to address and meet your needs and answer all your questions.
Awesome. Perfect. Great. Good job. Uliana, not bad for your first time. We're impressed. John, I know we're going to send it over to you. I know there's a big case that we want to discuss before we get into the whole PBM thing. So bring up, let's just do this as quickly as we can.
Yeah, it's relatively new. In a nutshell, California has passed a law to essentially eradicate what lots of people around the country are considering surprise bills. And what that means is that if you go to an in-network facility, but there are out-of-network physicians working in that facility, and that's something that we've all experienced at some point or another, whether you are on the patient side or the payer side, if that happens and an out-of-network physician is unknowingly used in an in-network facility, those out-of-network physicians are not allowed to charge their normal out-of-network fees and the plans are not required to pay them. What the California law says is that the payment from the plan to the provider is limited in such an instance, and that's the second bullet here. The greater of the average contracted rate, or 125% of Medicare. Now, some of you may be asking, where did they come up with 125% of Medicare? The answer is, it's hard to know, but it's obviously something that the state legislature has deemed reasonable in some respect. Remember, it's the greater of the average contracted rate or 125% of Medicare. So if contracted rates are much, much higher, fine. But if contracted rates are lower than 125% of Medicare, which in some parts of the country they are, or of course for some facilities they are, well, that's just the name of the game then. 125% of Medicare was deemed reasonable by the California legislature. Of course, not in every circumstance, but in this circumstance. Now, the reason this is a case and not just this law was passed is because it's being challenged. People are angry about this law. And who is angry, you might ask? Well, it's the doctors, of course. The doctors that formerly took advantage of charging basically anything they wanted when patients had no choice but to, for example, get anesthesia from an out-of-network provider, even in an in-network facility. It's nonsense. We all know that. Everyone on this webinar today knows that. And actually, if you don't agree, you might want to just disconnect now.
No, don't tell them that.
We want to be educated, Josh. Right. That. So basically, what the folks suing to call this law unconstitutional are saying a few things. One is that it deprives providers of the fair market value of their services. Basically, they're saying by limiting the amount that health plans are required to pay and that patients are required to pay, the provider does not get its full bill charges. And I think I speak for California when we say, yes, that's the whole point. The second thing is allowing disinterested parties to set rates. Basically, the providers are saying there, well, why should the California legislature get to decide what I earn for my services? Perhaps that's a valid point, but it also ties into the fair market value. I mean, one person's idea of the fair market value is very, very different from another person's idea of the fair market value, which I think is why we're in this conundrum to begin with. And this last argument is a very interesting one, and it doesn't actually directly relate to healthcare, but basically they're suggesting that out-of-network physicians will withdraw from low-income and minority communities because they will not receive the value that they need to remain viable. Essentially, it is saying that you are disadvantaging minority and low-income communities because they won't have physicians anymore. Now, the merits of that argument, I can't begin to opine on that. I don't have any stats to comment on that at all. But I think it's fair to say that the court will look at that and likely say that this is kind of an unintended consequence of the law. And I expect that they will say that this is kind of an invalid argument.
But I think it's a pretty interesting situation in that, you know, this is obviously a big deal. It's a big case. And what the key thing to remember, this is based on California law, so this would not affect the whole entire country. But I think this is the type of situation where if you're a patient going to an in-network facility, the issue for these physicians is going to be, listen, these patients didn't choose, so this isn't pure market forces. It's not like the patient chose this particular physician. They went to an in-network facility,
right,
assuming everything's in-network, not knowing that this particular doctor isn't in the network. Therefore, you can't just subject them to some random balance bills,
right,
which I think is the main issue. But we'll give you more information on that case as we go along. As always, guys, please visit us on social media for our LinkedIn and Twitter contest. Go on there, post some feedback about our webinar at the FIA Group, and you'll win 1 hour of free consultative services. Now let's talk about the overview of what we want to talk about today. And when it comes to PBM specifically, trending and spending, you're going to see some information here that's going to shock you. Forget the $1 million hospital bill. Forget about the $300,000 air ambulance claim. At least with that $300,000 air ambulance claim, it's one ride. You're not going to have a repeat. These drugs, people stay on them for a while. Second, I believe that Democrat versus Republicans is what the second one is. We're going to talk about the differences there. And what you'll notice is that there's a lot of differences, but we don't think either party has any idea of how to actually reduce the spend here or the trends. Third, PBM contracts. We're going to go into specifics. Again, you can contact our legal team to review your specific PBM. Please do not send us questions asking us what we think of the XYZ PBM contract, page 3, subsection 5. We don't know, and we couldn't give you an answer within the next 40 minutes anyways. Last but not least, this is the biggest part. Substituting a PBM, supplementing a PBM, or subtracting a PBM. Very, very important. We're going to talk about the three different options, and there are various options out there on what to do. We'll share some of the things that we're doing as well. But with that, I'm going to turn it back over to John Jablon to talk about some of the trending and spending that we're seeing across the country now.
Thanks, Adam. This first graph here, admittedly, there is newer information, but this presented the information that we wanted to convey. So it only goes up to 2014, but the trends shown here are absolutely still going on now. And basically what this is showing is the specialty drug trend, the traditional drug trend, and the overall drug trend. Of course, those are the three important things to look at, but obviously specialty drug trends are what many people are concerned about specifically. I can't tell you how many questions we get on a daily basis about specialty drugs and what can be done about them. But these numbers here just represent that apparently in 2003, sorry, there was a huge, huge uptick in the spend, especially for specialty drugs. It looks like traditional and the overall spend went up much less dramatically, of course still up, but the specialty drug trend jumped from 14.1% from 30.9%, which is truly scary. There's actually a really great Time Magazine article that talks about why drug prices are so high. And it's interesting because they named a few things. They went into a little bit of detail, but you know, just like so many other sources, it's hard to find someone who's willing to tackle the issue and suggest what can actually be done about it. So this is a great article to read to kind of diagnose the issue, but as to how to fix it, well, that's where we all come in and collaboration and whatnot. So the first thing they said is that unlike everywhere else in the world, just about, United States drug manufacturers are able to set their own prices. There's no regulation. That is a key point, and I think that one of the candidates is looking to increase regulation. There are a lot of ideas floating around, and as Adam said, I don't think anybody really has a great idea of what can be done, but it does look like increased regulation is on everybody's mind. The second is that the flawed patent system, rather, enables monopolies. The patent system is crazy in our country, right? It's been set up with inventions in mind and creativity and benefiting the public as a whole. So when someone creates something great, that person has rights to it for quite a while. But in the drug context here, that really, pardon my French, it really screws a lot of us, and for a very long time to boot. So similar to that is the generic approval process takes too long. That has been a criticism in the industry for years. It is not going anywhere. There have been really no signs at significant reform of the approval process, and I do think that that ties into the whole concept of the patent system, because people are not really ready to what would essentially be lessening the rights of individuals who do invent these drugs and then sell the rights. There's also an issue that state law is a barrier to lowering the cost, and an example that I put here is requiring specific patient consent to get a generic. Now, as any of you TPAs, brokers, or health plans can attest to, there's no need to require patient consent in order to give the patient a generic drug instead of a name brand drug. There's state laws on the books that do exactly that, and what that is a way, and I don't think that this was the intent of these laws, but it is a way that patients can be assured that they will get name brand drugs instead of generic drugs, and that just seems nuts. And then lastly is unjustified pricing based on costs of research and development. We all know that research and development is expensive. No one is deluding themselves into thinking that drugs just come on the market like that, and they're easy, and they're tested, and it takes $10 and 20 minutes, and that's it. No, of course that's not it. But the fact remains that the pricing is unregulated and unjustified, as it is with the medical market in general. And that's a problem that we are all continually facing, and drugs are absolutely no different. So I'm going to turn it over now to our very own Ron Peck, who's going to talk about some of the costliest drugs and other things.
All right. Thanks, John.
Yeah.
So speaking of expensive specialty drugs, these are just actually a few examples of the most expensive specialty drugs as reported by TheBalance.com. Of course, you know, we've seen presentations and reports with other specialty drugs listed as far as the most costly drugs. Sometimes the price itself is not the most egregious element. You know, for instance, we just got a comment that indicates, you know, how is it that some drugs that have been on the market for years and years, the price actually continues to go up 10, 15, 20% year after year. the longer the drug is on the market, you, normally when it comes to a consumer good, the longer something's on the market, the price is going to decrease, especially with competition. As well as the R&D prices that John had mentioned are usually written into the initial charge, so where the additional charge is coming from as it goes up year after year. And, you know, one thing that we've seen in the market is, you know, they'll come out with a medication, a drug, for a particular use, and they're going to charge a certain amount for it. And when it comes time for, intellectual property rights, patent rights, R&D, charging, the prices, these things are starting to come to an end. Lo and behold, a new use is discovered, or an alternative use for the medication is discovered. And this opens an entire another line of research and sale of the drug for a different purpose. So, you know, that's something that you sometimes see. Maybe they'll change the actual composition of the drug, make an improvement, things like that as well. So when I go online and I look at these different drugs and I look at what they're for, the actual diseases and conditions that they relate to, look, I you know, I'm a father, I'm a husband, I see people suffering from these conditions. And trust me, no one, I think, either listening or speaking today is saying that these medications don't serve a purpose. Everything from destruction of red blood cells, the inability to break down sugars, a lot of this has to do with swelling and physical attacks. I wouldn't suggest it, but go online and look at the pictures and you're going to see these people are suffering and they need this medication. But at the same time, that being said, how can you justify, just as an example, $440,000 a year for this drug Soliris, when, frankly, I think that that's actually more than the entire Cleveland Indians payroll for the year. So on the one hand, people are suffering. Clearly, they need this medication. We need to identify a way to obtain this medication for these people, but at the same time, address these rising costs. And just eliminating the drugs from coverage is not how you do this.
So we get more and more questions about how to eliminate drugs from coverage.
Yeah.
By many brokers across the country, which, you know, obviously we want to give answers, but sometimes I'm like, man, you know, is that really where how people want to strategize on how to lower the overall cost of their health spend by just eliminating access to drugs?
Oh, absolutely.
The pushback on that from a public publicity standpoint, I think, would be huge.
Yeah, when you mention that, Adam, I mean, you look at, for instance, Cinryze, this drug, you know, go online, look at the children who are suffering from the condition that this drug is meant to treat. Now, just imagine that's one of the plan participants' kids, one of the employees' kids who's suffering from this condition. They report to the NAIC or you know, their local congressman or congresswoman that, oh, hey, you know, my kid, I've been working for this company for 20, 30 years. I've been paying my dues, my contributions. And then when my kid ends up with this condition, they're not going to cover the drug. Here's a picture of my kid with his eyes swelling shut. Trust me, that doesn't look good for the self-funded industry or for employers either. So there's both the actual human interest element, but then there's also just the self-preservation element, that just eliminating these in the short term might save you some cash, but in the long term, it's not going to look good from a regulatory standpoint. Thanks for that, Adam. So, you know, again, for those of you who didn't get to read the article by this incredible author, Ron Peck, it's a great read, and I suggest you look it up. It's got some nice pictures, illustrations. That's always, you know, a reason to go check it out. But, you know, this is, again, just an example of how the cost actually plays into it. It's like one of those things where they show you a pie chart, right, and you're focusing on one slice of the pie, and it certainly, you know, is not the rest of the pie. The entire pie is way larger than that one slice. And you say to yourself, well, I guess that slice is not that big a piece, until you realize that the rest of the pie is comprised of all these tiny little slices, and this is actually the biggest of the bunch. Add to that the fact that the, you know, in this case, the drug costs are not only the probably one of the, if not the biggest slice of pie, it's also the one that's growing at the fastest rate. So we're not only talking about a huge chunk of your cost compared to other costs, but it's also the one that's growing most exponentially. So am I saying that right now this is going to bankrupt your plan, specialty drugs and pharmaceuticals? No. But can it in a year or two? Better believe it.
One of the reasons why I would say to make sure you follow us on LinkedIn, for example, or Twitter, is because all of these articles, and we average about an article a week in some other magazine. I know Brady Bizarro, one of our attorneys, just had an article published today. Is one of the big reasons I would definitely go on there. But again, as Jen is going to share with you, there are some things that the public feels strongly about and what we could do potentially about the rising drug costs. Jen?
Yeah, so I feel like I get to be the buffer here before Ron goes into a really dramatic explanation about what you need to know before you vote in the next week or so. But anyway, so, I mean, I don't think anyone can argue at this point that something needs to get done. When we're talking about drugs, there's no doubt that they can certainly get expensive, and there's something that needs to get done. So recently there was just about a month and a half ago, there was a Kaiser survey that asked for some public opinions about what we can do to help keep the cost of prescription drugs down. And no surprise that the majority of the people who took this poll agreed that certain policy actions must be taken to address these rising drug costs. So as far as a couple of the highlights about what was on this survey, the first is talking about requiring these drug companies to release information to the public about how they set their drug prices. I also do want to note here that I do appreciate being able to communicate with you guys about some math here, about these different percentages. So as far as those who are okay and are in favor of releasing this information, 86% is a pretty overwhelming number. 8 in 10 people think that there needs to be some change about the transparency, which mirrors really what it is we've been saying about benefits and healthcare costs for years at this point. So why wouldn't we want this to not only be true for medical expenses, but also for prescription drug expenses? Why do they always need to be secret? The next item that was on this poll is talking about allowing Medicare to negotiate with drug companies for lower costs. Obviously, 8 in 10 also feel that this is something that should be taken as a step forward in order to lower the cost of drugs. And also limiting the amount of drug companies and what they can charge for high-cost drugs for illnesses and things like hepatitis C. I think the last one, which is pretty important, actually, I believe that this was something that had been really important as far as conversations we've had in the past about allowing individuals to buy drugs that are imported, prescription drugs, that have been imported from Canada or other countries. This has been something we've been talking about for a while as far as the cost or what can we do? What can we look to as another solution for how we can supplement what our current coverage is right now when you're looking at a PBM and how cost can be managed or at least controlled? And one item that's not necessarily on here, but I think it's good to know that Ron's going to talk about this a little bit further in the next couple of slides, but we were talking about how we can create some sort of independent group that's going to oversee the cost and the prices of prescription drugs. That was actually something that had been set forth by Hillary Clinton. So I do think that there are different really important topics about what our candidates' personal opinions aside about what it is that they think would be an appropriate action for us to alleviate and reduce costs. So
what I can tell you right now is in that in regards to that last bullet point in regard to buying prescription drugs, there are many municipalities, not private employers. There are hundreds that we know of, probably thousands that we don't know of, municipalities across the country that have been having their employees buy prescription drugs from other countries, typically Canada, and have been doing so for years. We actually have that as part of what we do. If you want information on who we use and how we do it, feel free to contact us. But this is something that I can tell you, yeah, people say, well, it's illegal or is it legal? There's a lot of gray area. We have looked at, we have done many legal opinions, advisory opinions in regards to this subject. But it's less about whether you can or cannot. It's more about how you actually do it. Allowing an individual to buy a drug from another country isn't a problem. But as you can see, 7 out of 10 people think it's a good idea. Many cities and municipalities across the country are already doing it. Ron, I mean, John.
Okay. All right. So this is Ron. It's hard. I know. We should. I'm thinking when we're done here, John and I should open some sort of a sporting shop, maybe something.
Well, you've got seniority, so I'll have to change my name.
Right. That's right. Works.
We can call Ron John.
Jonathan.
There you go. Or we can call him Javon. Speaking of competition and importing drugs from other countries, you know, people like to throw that idea of competition out there. That's certainly one thing that you're going to hear repeated at the political level. In addition to that, you know, looking specifically at some of the things that Hillary's mentioned, Hillary Clinton about the cost of medication and drugs, you know, you hear about price caps on cost sharing or rebate programs for low-income Medicare beneficiaries. And while that's well and good, I have two things to say about that. First and foremost, you know, low-income Medicare beneficiaries, rebate programs, that's to help someone who's on Medicare with their out-of-pocket expense. We're not talking about plan participants, whether you're a participant of Medicare, a fully insured product, or a self-funded plan, your out-of-pocket expense. No, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the ability of the plan itself to purchase the medication. Frankly, I don't care if my out-of-pocket is $100 or $1,000. If my drug is $500,000 and my employer can't pay for it after, you know, 2 or 3 months of doses, guess what? It doesn't matter how much I'm paying out of pocket, I can't get the drug. So again, that's just one issue, the fact that the focus is on what the patient is paying out of pocket rather than what we're actually paying as a whole for the drug. Who pays for it is less important than what's being paid, and nobody seems to care about that. The second thing regarding competition, you know, Hillary Clinton mentions increased funding for the Office of Generic Drugs, decrease approval backlog. That's great. Get more generics out there more quickly. Great idea. Reducing market exclusivity period for biologics. What are we talking about here? We're talking about competition. But again, I've seen examples of pharmaceutical companies, developers, they've been able to game the system when it comes to intellectual property, like I mentioned before, identifying a new use or changing the formula enough that they can re-up their intellectual property rights, their patent. Penalization for drug companies, unjustified increases. Of course, this is in everybody's craw now because of the EpiPen and the pricing there. But who defines what an unjustified increase is? I mean, frankly, I'm an attorney. I could justify anything, right? And you look at, for instance, the example we talked about early on with the California, that law where they passed where they tried to put a cap on what out-of-network providers can charge. Remember we had that conversation? And what's the response? Who are you to tell us what's fair and what's not? How do you know what the right price is? Can't you imagine the same arguments being made here when someone says, oh, well, that's an unjustified increase. And then, of course, the FDA approval of advertisements. Believe it or not, advertising, marketing, those things are all tied up into the cost that drugs are actually.
And here's the thing about that. A lot of these issues, we firmly believe you can resolve with plan design, particularly that many of these branded drugs will offer reimbursement programs for copays to members. So people actually think, oh, wow, it's actually cheaper for me to have a branded drug than a generic drug because I'm getting reimbursed by the manufacturer. That's the kind of stuff that you could put into a plan design change where you are actually incentivizing your employees. Trust me, everyone says they do it. 5 out of the 10 plans that we look at still do not, we don't feel, put enough emphasis on getting people to utilize generic drugs over branded. There's no question about that.
And you look at, for instance, again, that last bullet, FDA approval of advertisements. What are you up against, right? I mean, these drug companies, the marketing,
right,
it's a juggernaut. How are you going to go up against those two people in their bathtubs next to each other with your generic?
Now, on this Trump one, I know John's going to touch base, but this first one, you know, I mean, Ron's going to touch base on it. Sorry, I keep saying, John, why? What is my thing with you today?
He's looking really good today.
I know what it is. He took a shower. I look at this, you know, importation of reliable but lower-cost drugs. You know, we just talked about it. It's already happening. A lot of this is already happening, whether it's from New Zealand or from Canada or et cetera. I don't know if I'd want to get the drug from a, you know, third world country, but, you know, from Canada and New Zealand, I mean, they're not third world, they may be second world, but they're still, you know, that is already happening, right?
And it's funny, too, because when you look at something, for instance, you know, Donald Trump, he's mentioning promoting competition. Well, you know, Hillary Clinton was saying increased generics and reducing exclusivity in the market.
That's
increasing competition.
Right.
So the truth is, I mean, everybody's saying the same thing. The only problem is you're going to get such pushback from the drug companies because they're going to say, well, the reason that Canadians can sell my drug for so cheap is because the Americans are subsidizing it.
And now we'll pass it over to John. Sorry about that.
It's okay. PBMs, they are not evil. We know this. Just like networks, some are good, some are better, some are not so good, some are terrible. You know, that's the nature of the beast. They do, however, provide some valuable services. It's no secret. No one would use PBMs if they literally provided no valuable services.
And I think it's really important. You know, I'm reading these emails that were coming in, and one of my best friends in the industry, I'm just going to say his first name is Scott, you know, brings us some good points. We do purchase drugs as employers and as administrators from the PBMs. So here's what we know. Not all PBMs are the same. So when you hear that out there, we can name all the companies. Trust me, we have reviewed each one of them, okay? And there's a bunch of services they provide, but John's going to get into detail as to the differences between them all. Here's the reality. Even us, as a self-funded employer, we have a hard time getting PBM data.
Yeah.
And we're in the business. So never mind the other organizations that are just, you know, manufacturing widgets.
what do they do when they're trying to get this information as well? So some of the stuff that PBMs are able to do, John, are what?
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing is development of a formulary. Which drugs are available through the PBM, which are not? I mean, for every condition, or for just about every condition, there are multiple possible drugs. I mean, there are a few conditions that require, absolutely require, one specific drug, and even fewer that require one specific name brand drug. Of course, that's where the real cost driver is when you do find those conditions, which is truly unfortunate. But the bottom line is the PBM develops the formulary and sets the kind of the schedule of the drugs. Now, of course, different PBMs will develop different formularies. And sometimes the formularies are able to be modified by individual groups or TPAs or brokers. And when a formulary can be modified to really suit an individual employer's needs, that is where typically the most bang for the buck can be gotten. Another thing is access to quality drugs and steerage to generics. Not much needs to be said about that, I think. Ideally, a PBM will steer to generics whenever possible. Perhaps the PBM makes a little bit less money when that is the case. But this is a service that is very, very valuable to employers. And I think that a lot of PBMs realize that if they don't steer to generics, if they don't make any attempt to really save money for employers, they're going to be out of the market pretty quickly. That brings me into discounted rates. Discounts. PBMs negotiate discounts with manufacturers. If you negotiate very good discounts, it adds value. If you negotiate bad discounts or even no discounts, it decreases value. Again, no secret. It's the same with PPO networks. Great discounts, great value. No discounts, no value. There's also negotiation and administration of rebates. Rebates is a, or are a very, very hot topic across the field of PBMs. Rebates, as you all may know, are essentially dollars that go back either to the PBM or to the employer or even to the TPA when a particular drug or a subset of drugs are purchased from a particular manufacturer. Rebates are, or have been, rather, a bone of contention and continue to be a bone of contention throughout the entire industry. It doesn't matter who you are, whether you're a plan, TPA, stop loss, a PBM itself, or a broker, you faced some sort of issue with rebates in the past. And different PBMs treat rebates in very, very, very different ways. And we'll get into that a little bit on the next slide. Lastly, programs to improve health and minimum discount guarantees are other things that PBMs may offer. Minimum discount guarantees can be very, very valuable because when you're contracting with a PBM, they're not specifically promising that they will do any particular level of discounts unless they give you a guarantee. If they just say, yeah, we're going to get you some discounts, is it 1%? Is it 0.5%? There's no way of knowing.
I think one of the key things about PBM contracts is the fact that most people don't know what they say. Most people don't read them. You know, in the PPO world or the network world, I think more people have some type of opinion on it because they actually have been to enough webinars or read a couple pages. When it comes to PBM contracts, and John's going to talk about some of the things to look out for, it's just a different story. People just don't even know what is in them. So, John,
technical.
Can we talk about some of the things that are in these things in the PBM contracts and what to look out for?
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing, and this is very, very similar, maybe even identical to ordinary network contracts, non-PBM, that is, confidentiality of the manufacturer agreements. So when manufacturers have deals with the PBM, we don't know what those deals are. So that creates essentially what's known as spread pricing, and that's that bottom bullet there. Spread pricing is not identified in the PBM contract because if it were, people would see right through them. People would know that they would see that spread pricing and realize that why are you buying the drug for this amount and then charging me this amount times however many, whatever the multiple is. It's nonsense. Spread pricing is something that has been on a lot of people's mind for a long time, and unfortunately, we have not seen any indication that it is going away anytime soon. The lack of regulation is really the biggest factor in the PBM world and why so many of them add such little value. And it's really, truly unfortunate. Another aspect is arbitrary or non-transparent MAC pricing. There are some PBMs that have multiple MAC databases. Maybe they have full-time employees who scan the MAC databases in order to increase the spread and charge health plans and consumers who buy these drugs as much as possible while still maintain or while maximizing their own margins. Now, obviously, that's not something that is good for consumers, but it is something that happens all the time in the industry, especially specifically in these PBM contracts. Now, I mentioned this on the last slide, but the ability to amend the formulary is huge. There are a lot of PBM contracts that specifically say, we write the formulary, you abide by the formulary, end of story. Well, it shouldn't be the end of story. It really shouldn't. There are many TPAs out there that will say, look, we can amend the formulary, we can add things, we can subtract things, we can do what the employer needs to do, probably within reason, but obviously, you know, these are all business decisions for everyone involved, but the ability to amend the formulary can be huge. Now, we've been talking a little bit about procuring drugs from overseas or Canada, New Zealand, Zimbabwe, wherever, but the prohibition on accessing alternative sources is something that a lot of PBMs are big into. A lot of them will say, you get drugs from us, no one else, period, that's it. Now, that's also part of the reason why they might have such broad formularies, in order to say, any drugs you need, we've got them. But when the plan says, yeah, but I can get this one for 80% less, the PBM might still say, but you have to get it through us. There's no alternative. As we know, there are alternatives, but you might not be allowed to access those alternatives under the contract. Look at your contracts very carefully, or send them to us and we can look at them for you. But the bottom line is, there are a lot of PBM contracts that have provisions that are incredibly, incredibly unfavorable to health plans. Ron?
Sure. So if you don't feel comfortable with your current PBM situation, one option that's available to you is to change PBMs, substitute with a new PBM. Before we can say anything and suggest anything, you need to assess your situation, right? If you're self-funding, for instance, with an ASO or a carrier, you know, just the same with stop loss. You know, what they'll tell you is, look, it's our way or the highway. You know, this is our carrier. This is our PBM. If you want to use our plan and be administered by us, you need to use these tools that we provide you with. If that's the case, it's more than just substituting your PBM. It's a whole other conversation. But assuming you have the ability to look at other PBMs, you have to look at the things that John just talked about. These are the things that are important when it comes to selecting your PBM. Things like transparent pricing and rebate administration.
The rebate administration, I think we need to focus on. That's a big piece of it. I think a lot of employers have no idea.
Enormously so.
That they're getting rebate, that they have the ability to even obtain rebate.
Oh, yeah. And there are multiple types of rebates, too. That's what's also funny is, you know, there'll be two types of rebates. What they'll do is one category of rebate, they'll say goes to the plan, and that's the smaller of the two, and they're not even going to reference the other.
I think a big part of this is no different than when we get a phone call from a broker or a consultant or advisor, and they say, we have a self-funded employer. We have an employer who wants to do X, Y, and Z with your organization. The first thing we say is, get us a copy of your administrative service agreement to see what you can and cannot do. It's no different here. So before you decide what you want to try, and Ron's going to talk about supplementing later on, right after this slide, you have to actually see, when you're choosing the PBM that you want to work with, what you can do. Because as Ron said, there are some good ones. There are definitely the ones that are the best of the worst that you can work with that will be more transparent, will have the right information, right language in their rebate administration, will allow you to carve out some of the things. But, you know, I just want to make sure we emphasize, I believe the rebate issue is a major, major problem.
Well, sure, and I mean, you know, along the same lines, Adam, we just recently dealt with an issue where the PBM and the drug manufacturer collaborated together to create a program where the patient is actually given essentially a gift card. It's a coupon that's equal to the deductible, their out-of-pocket. So what ends up happening is they go in, they get this very expensive drug, the plan is paying, you know, the majority of the price tag. Sort of the thing that's meant to disincentivize the use of this type of drug, a high deductible, it's being paid by the manufacturer, and there's nothing they can do about it from the out-of-pocket perspective. So there's a lot of games that are being played. You need to be careful. You need to select wisely. But like Adam said, before you can do anything, you need to look and see if your contract will allow it, because otherwise that would be deemed a breach of contract if you do something a contract does not allow.
What we would advise you to do is supplement. That's what we do here. So what we have done is we try to work with the best of the PBMs that allow you to actually have carve-outs for specific things.
because some, just like with the PPO networks, they're all different. The PPO contract, some will allow you to carve out things, others won't. We're seeing a lot more flexibility in that world now. You're seeing the same exact thing when it comes to PBMs, especially some of the startup PBMs. So, Ron,
Yeah, definitely. And like we said, you know, you're probably going to have to first substitute and then supplement. There are a full gamut of services that are out there regarding drug costs, things that will allow you to examine drugs, the expenses on a claim-by-claim basis. Somebody was just diagnosed, they need to get a specialty drug. You go and you see a specialist who could give you the pricing and help you negotiate down that claim, all the way through to somebody that's scrubbing all of the data and helping you reduce your total drug spend. You know, things where, for instance, the classics, right, get people on generics, get them to do the mail order, use your copays and deductibles as incentives, straight through a hands-on patient sort of concierge service, monitoring the drugs. Another thing, not just the cost of the drug, but ensuring people are taking the right medication, right, that they're not being prescribed something that's incorrect for their condition, so the diagnosis. Ensuring that people are not continuously refilling the drug when, frankly, they're supposed to have concluded their dosage. So there's just a lot of things that you need to do to ensure not only are you purchasing the right drugs at the right cost, but in the right quantity as well. So we call that oversight and advocacy on the plan's behalf. Remember, the PBM serves a certain purpose. That purpose may not be to advocate on the part of the plan. You may need someone who actually is in there as your advocate in the exchange. Also, we talked about things like obtaining drugs from outside sources. People have complained that, well, you know, I can get the drug from an outside source, but if I need a facility, if I need a provider to actually administer that drug, can they push back and say, well, I only administer drugs that I purchase? That's a huge issue, too.
One of the key things I would focus on, if you don't mind, Ron, just supplementing a little bit, is talking about the plan advocacy for PBMs and the drug usage oversight. So we actually know of some vendors out there that do a really good job when it comes to this, because obviously people need the drug, but how they actually use them, when they use them, overusage, underusage, whatever it might be, wasted drugs is a big part of the, is a big part of the game. When it comes to hemophilia, you know, people, again, you hope that you don't have a hemophiliac on your plan, but we know of many, many clients of ours that have brought this up. We're spending $1 million here on hemophiliac claims. Well, there are options out there for hemophilia. There's networks that have been specialized networks for just for hemophiliacs. The 20 of them out there. I don't know how many there are, but that is a big part. In addition to that supplement is the pricing and the educational tools. There are some really good partners of ours that we work with that have access to information on alternative usage, alternative means to have educational information regarding some of these drugs. I can tell you this. We have a specific person, that's, you know, Scott, that just keeps texting us different questions. Obviously, we should have just had him as a guest speaker today because he just keeps on bringing up stuff. But at the end of the day, you know, there's so much that goes into these network contracts, I mean, these PBM contracts, from rebates all the way to, you know, turning off prior authorizations, the scam that that potentially could be. At the end of the day, if you have a PBM that you're working with that you, and you've noticed that your drug spend is going up or you're not feeling that you're getting enough resources or information regarding the PBM or you're working with, I would say to contact us to see what you potentially could do in that regard.
And lastly, really quickly, I'm going to touch on subtracting the PBM. Is PBM free the way to be? That's the question of the day, isn't it? Just like reference-based pricing helps plans get rid of their networks, there is a possibility of just not using a PBM at all. Now, yes, it is going to be more complicated. Yes, it is going to increase the administrative burden. No, most of your groups will not go for it, but it is possible. It's very, very similar to not using a PPO. We would always encourage signing direct contracts with pharmacies and trying to work out deals, but at the end of the day, discounts are still possible even without a PBM. A PBM is absolutely not the only way to get discounts on drugs.
No different than how you know right now you have more and more employers looking at reference-based pricing as an example for just claim services or normal services. The same thing is starting to happen now when it comes to PBMs. Direct contracting, not focusing on discounts, but focusing on the actual unit cost of a particular drug. We're noticing more of that. We're getting a lot of questions from people asking us what you can and cannot put into a plan design. Guys, think 3 years back when we started doing these webinars to like 10 listeners, right? And we would tell them,
it's not just what you put in the plan doc, it's what your network contract says. It's no different here. You can put all the provisions you want. Here's what I can tell you. With a FIA group, when we do our own plan design, we have a self-funded plan, we have a stop-loss policy, we have an employee handbook, we have a PBM contract. We start looking at this stuff in August, start asking all of our staff to give us feedback on changes. Then once we have all the changes that we want to put in, then we actually take all the documents and do a gap analysis amongst them, between them, to say, we said that here, but you can't do that here, and then we have to make a compromise for position. There is no different when it comes to PBMs. So when we have, and this is happening over and over again, we're getting dozens of people telling us, oh, you can write this in the plan design. Well, if you sign a PBM contract that says the exact opposite, you can't just rely on your plan design. So again, we're just concerned that people will start doing that without looking at everything else. That's all the time we got for today, obviously. Feel free to join us November 15th at 1 o'clock for HCA's special joint webinar regarding the good, the bad, and the naughty, ethics, simple mistakes versus breach. And our last webinar of the year, the 2017 FIA forecast, it's been an action-filled hour. We appreciate it. We literally received a record number of questions. I think it's over 100. We promise to respond to each one, except for that one guy, Scott's. We'll give him one phone call. That's it, to go over all this stuff. But everyone else, we will email you directly. And as always, on behalf of Jen, Ron, John, and myself, thank you so much for dialing in. We're very humbled by the fact that so many hundreds of you decide to do it every single month. We appreciate it, and we'll see you on November 15th. Thank you very much.